to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Yet another shipwreck has been discovered in Lake Michigan. And, you know, the guy that led the group that found it is with us in the studio right now. Brendan Balod is back with us. He's president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, and he's going to share details of the ship they've found. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions as we move along today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Brendan Balod, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Great to have you back. Well, this summer you served as the principal investigator for the search of the sunken wreck of the F.J. King. And that ship sank in Lake Michigan in 1886. And you found it. How big a deal is that discovery?
Well, for us, it was huge. Yeah. We had found a couple of other vessels out there over the years. in fact, every year I think we've found a couple because new sources have become available. It's I wouldn't say it's easy to find them, not all of them, but this one was special to us because it had been really elusive. A number of groups had tried to find it over the years. Even when it was lost in 1886, the keeper of the Cana Island Lighthouse had reported that its masts were breaking the surface. And they asked a revenue cutter to come and take the masts out because it was a hazard to navigation. When the revenue cutter got there a few days later, it was gone. It had just vanished. Fast forward to the 1970s. People are looking for the ship. It's become part of the cultural history of Door County. People want to find this, ship. And no one can find it. Commercial fishermen are bringing up pieces of a schooner in their nets off Cana Island Light. But when they go out to the site where the pieces are brought up, there's nothing there. It had gotten so elusive that the local dive club offered a $1,000 reward for its discovery. We didn't really expect to find it,
But you did in pretty short order. Let's back up. What was the describe that ship, the F.J. King? What kind of a ship was it?
She was a canal schooner. So this is a ship that was built for the grain trade on the Great Lakes in the 1860s. She was built at Toledo, Ohio in 1867. And to give that some context, right after the Civil War, right, the Lake Michigan port cities, on particularly in Wisconsin and Chicago, were the biggest primary grain markets in the world. More grain was flowing out of Milwaukee than any place else in the world. Millionaires were being minted every year by delivering this prairie gold to the cities of the East. Because if you were eating a ham sandwich in New York City in 1867, the wheat that made that bread came from Wisconsin. That's not that way anymore. But these vessels, there was just a huge fleet of them. There were hundreds and hundreds of these schooners. And they call them canal schooners because they were built to go through the Welland Canal around Niagara Falls. So they could trade with Oswego, New York. And most of their cargoes would go to Buffalo and Oswego and then down the New York State Canal systems. That's sort of the context. These ships, by the time the F.J. King was lost in 1886, there were probably 2,000 of vessels this plying the Great Lakes. And, they had to go out in the fall when the weather was its worst. Because that's
when the wheat came in.
And the coal had to be delivered and all the raw goods because, for processing over the winter. And they had no modern weather forecasting. They'd sail out into the gales of November, sometimes never to be seen again.
So the gales of November caused it? What caused the ship to sink?
Well, in this case, she was in bad weather. It was probably 8 to 10 foot waves, but the weather isn't what did her in. The F.J. King was lost because of age and decrepitude is what I'd say. Now, she had just been given a rebuild, but it was her upper works. They put new decks on her. They actually added a third mast to her because they wanted she had outlived her usefulness as a grain carrier. So on the Great Lakes, if a vessel had so much hull rot and was so old, it couldn't carry grain anymore. So they decided to put her in the iron ore trade. Well, iron ore cargoes are pretty heavy. And they're very hard on these old hulls, and they didn't re-caulk this hull. And it hadn't carried iron ore in years. When it had left Escanaba, Michigan, with a cargo of raw iron ore, and it was coming down the Door Peninsula. It was bound for Chicago, And when it got off the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal, they started to leak and leak bad. They put all the men to the pumps and they turned because they couldn't make it. The wind wasn't favorable. It's a schooner. They had to tack and jibe. They couldn't get into the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal. So they ran north for Bailey's Harbor, North Bay. They wanted to beach it. And the men were losing the battle. And they'd been up for many, many hours fighting for their lives, literally. And as they came off of the Can Island light, they saw the lights of a schooner approaching, the La Petite. And they knew that that was their time to abandon the ship. If they didn't get off then, they were going down with the ship. So they got in the little yawl boat, rowed for the lights of the schooner that was coming. And as they did, the bow of the F.J. King slid down beneath the waves and the iron ore rushed forward. And the force of the wind blowing backward from that blew the rear cabin 50 feet in the air. The captain's papers went flying all over the place. There was a huge explosion sound as the stern of the vessel literally ripped open. And the men were picked up by the schooner and taken to shore.
And you know all this because probably because of the captain, I would guess, would have had to file a report.
Well, the captain did. He filed a rec report with the Customs Bureau in his own hand. And in the rec report, he said he thought he was about 6 miles off Can Island Light. We questioned that because that's where Vunen had been looking. And that area had been searched a lot by a lot of people. What happens when we reinvestigate a wreck? It's kind of like a cold case, like reinvestigating a cold case. When I go into it, I'll sometimes start from scratch. Like I won't look at any previous researcher's work. I'll just go in and start collecting raw data. And in this case, we found a piece of evidence that nobody had seen before. It had been missed by other researchers. And that was that the Canna Island lighthouse keeper, when he said he saw the masts breaking the surface, he told one news outlet what the range and bearing was to the masts, and only one news outlet. And I found that newspaper account that said how far out and in what direction the masts were. So I thought, well, you know, we should reinvestigate that. Just rule that bottom out, you know. So I drew a 2-mile by 2-mile box around where he said the masts were, and the ship was a quarter of a mile away. It was hiding in plain sight.
Oh, my gosh. Brendan Baylott, our guest today, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. We're talking about his group finding the F.J. King sank in Lake Michigan in 1886, and all kinds of people have been trying to find it. Questions about the King or about other ships, perhaps. They found five, I think, in the last couple of years. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here as we talk with Brendan Baylott, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, about the finding of the F.J. King ship that sank in Lake Michigan in 1886. Questions or comments? I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234 or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. A quick mention, coming up at 11:45, we'll talk to a couple of folks relating to the Portage County Historical Society. And at 12:30, we'll talk to best-selling author David Sedaris. But right now, we're talking shipwrecks with Brendan and having some fun doing it. I hope you'll join in. On June 28th, your team chartered a tour vessel to look for the ship out from Bailey's Harbor. How confident were you that you were going to find it?
Well, we really didn't expect to find it. WUA is a citizen science group where we provide opportunities for the public to participate in underwater archaeology. And, you know, more and more people aren't scuba diving to do that. We're doing it through remote sensing. So we're bringing people out and giving them a chance to, you know, use our side scan sonar, to use our remote operated vehicles, and to really participate in underwater archaeology through remote sensing. And that was the point of this. We wanted to get people out on the boat and kind of show them how the sausage was made, so to speak, you know, and let them participate. And there was a chance we'd find the wreck. It was exciting. You know, and we told him that. We said, no guarantee. We did have people sign an archaeological stewardship agreement. What we don't want is we want to give the state a chance to document the site pre-disturbance. So our state underwater archaeologist, Tamara Thompson, is a close working partner of ours. And all the wrecks we find, she goes out and documents them very carefully before they're released to the public. So everyone had to sign this agreement to say, oh, we're not going to talk.
Keep your mouth shut.
And they were really good about it. So we got out there and we started searching that grid. And we had made one pass. We turned and we were coming back on our second pass. And, you know, we joke around and say, keep your eye on the screen, you know, something might happen. And all of a sudden, we see this big object start to crawl across the screen. It was the first thing we'd seen. And we could see rocks. We could see all sorts of features. But all of a sudden, we see hatches. We see a deck. We just couldn't believe it. We were pinching ourselves. It was just a surreal moment. People got their cell phones out, started taking pictures of the screen. Some people started high-fiving. And I immediately measured it on the screen because we can do that. And it was the exact right length. And we knew we had found the FJ King.
Oh, man. That, you know, the technology on that is really, I mean, and this technology has improved a lot and also probably gotten a little more, a little less expensive over time.
Yeah, our side-scanning sonar that we have was made in Sweden by a company called Deep Vision, and they gave us a grant to get it, which was very nice of them. It's an archaeological sonar, but it also can find things that are quite a distance out. We could see about 900 feet away from the boat on either channel. And so we were covering a pretty good-sized swath of the bottom with it. But our remote-operated vehicles are really kind of what people were excited about because we put them in the water right as soon as we found it. We anchored the boat over it, and we said, okay, swim them down. And our members got to be the first people to lay eyes on that ship since 1886. And everyone on the boat got to swim those ROVs around and see that ship as it lay on the bottom. It was an amazing moment. We got video of it. All of our participants got to, you know, take part in it and in our events following it. So it was a really great experience. And we're going to do it again next year with a different wreck.
we'll talk about that in a few minutes, I should say. But what an exciting moment for everyone. How deep was what was the depth there?
Well, the FJ King lies in between 110 and 140 feet of water. It's on a bit of a hillside. She is in pretty good shape, so we expected to find what we call fillet of schooner because she was carrying iron ore, and when those things hit the bottom with iron ore, they blow up. Instead, what we found was a ship that was mostly intact. She stands upright and intact on the bottom. The only thing that's missing is her rear deck has been blown off. And she has some damage to her starboard bow where she struck bottom. But otherwise, she's standing upright and intact. She stands about 18 feet off the bottom. She's huge. I mean, the size of a large building, really. This is a huge object to have been missing for so long.
That is amazing. And the photo you do on your site, you've got a photo, is really almost surreal.
That is a photogrammetry model. So our state underwater archaeologist, Tamara Thompson, and Zach Whitrock, who is one of their volunteers, dove the wreck a few months after we found it. And they created a model by taking over 5,000 high-resolution images, which they then have stitched together into a 3D spatial model using software. And we can give tours of the wreck using, you know, a 3D virtual reality headset where you can literally walk down the deck. You can walk around the wreck on the bottom and look up at it and reach out and almost touch it. You can look down into the holds and see the iron ore down there. So we like to provide that 3D immersive experience for people so that they, but also those models show us what the wreck was like, because it's not going to be like that in 50 years or 100 years. They're perishable. So it's important that we use that to document as well.
And we have that 3D image. We have a link to that 3D image on today's program at the Larry Mueller Show. If you can go there, we'll be posting this show about 2 hours after the show's over, and you'll be able to take a look at it. Go to today's date at the Larry Mueller Show. Linda in Middleton has a question for you. Hi, Linda.
Yeah. Hi. Very fascinating. I'm wondering, are you ever think you're going to find the French schooner, the Griffin?
That's an interesting question. I have looked for the Griffin, not as a member of the WUAA, but personally. And I actually did a lot of work to translate the original letters from the French explorer La Salle about 15 years ago. He wrote about an 80-page letter where he discusses the debris from the Griffin that he was shown and the last accounts of the Griffin. We believe the Griffin disappeared off Sechouart Point. Translated into English, that means only choice point. That's the only place you can stop between the Door Peninsula and St. Ignace for shelter. We don't believe the Griffin is going to be an intact ship. We believe because of her age and the shallowness of the water up there and then the
wave action.
We believe she's going to have been reduced to a debris field and she'll be found through her anchors and her anvils. She was carrying a lot of ironwork to build a keel boat to go down the Mississippi River. And so that is a search that has to be done with what we call a magnetometer that looks for iron on the bottom as opposed to a side scan sonar. It's going to be a long time before she's found. This is not a ship that's going to be found easily or visually, and the search area is large. It's about 100 square miles.
And a magnetometer, what area would it, you know, as you pass over?
Not very good. A magnetometer, you have to get pretty close. It varies with the size of the ferrous object, but you have to be pretty much within maybe 100 yards, 50 yards, even closer to pick up an anvil. So it's just a long search, and it's going to be a hard search.
And that was, the Griffin was, when was that?
1679. She is the first decked vessel on the Western Great Lakes, and also the Western Great Lakes' first shipwreck. One of the biggest enduring mysteries on the Great Lakes. I'm well-versed in the wreck. I don't know that I'll go looking for it again. It's just, it's a long way to go. The weather's always bad up there. And there are other wrecks that are easier to find.
Okay, Linda, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. And you could join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us your questions about shipwrecks or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. So the citizen scientists, how does one become a shipwreck investigator or a citizen scientist?
Well, I mean, you don't have to join WUA, but we'd like it if you did. It's $20 a year, WUAA.org. And we put out an announcement about all our upcoming fieldwork trainings and projects. We give trainings on our equipment, and the projects are first come, first served. People sign up and get a space on the boat, and they come out with us. You don't have to have any special qualifications.
Oh.
If you're a member of the WUAA and you'd like to sign up for a project, we encourage it. We want the public to get involved and to experience this with us. It's our reason for being.
So the F.J. King, when the scientists, the citizen scientists, got to take part, they weren't diving down 150 feet.
We do everything via remote operated vehicle.
Yeah,
scuba diving. Although we do have members that scuba dive and draw the wrecks, most of our membership does it through remote sensing because it opens up the field. It opens up the ability to look at these wrecks to a much broader audience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. What do you think is the human psychology behind this fascination with finding sunken ships?
Why do we want to find them?
I think it's sort of the cold case aspect of it. People like to, you know, a good mystery, and they like it even better when it gets solved. And in the case of these shipwrecks, you know, you've just heard the question about the Griffin. It's a really enduring mystery. When we find the ships, it tells us a lot about what really happened. You know, what happened when it was lost? And, you know, why wasn't it found? In the case of the F.J. King, you know, the captain wasn't quite sure where he was. It was 1 a.m. when it went down. And he couldn't really see how far he was from shore. But those kind of things, I think, carry a fascination. I think also the old treasure hunting ethos, although on the Great Lakes, that's not really a thing anymore since the passage of conservation laws. But, you know, that's part of it. The thought about finding a shipwreck and finding treasure that also attracts people.
Kurt, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Trouble in Lodi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's a very interesting show. I'm interested in knowing if your guest knows what materials the ship, the King, was made out of. And I'm assuming it's made out of wood. And I'm curious to know what kinds of wood it was made out of. Black walnut? Or black locust?
Yeah.
It's an excellent question. So we know a lot about the shipbuilding on the Great Lakes because it was a huge industry. Almost every port city had a major shipyard, and they followed very standard methods. By that time, the insurance industry, by the 1840s, there were prescribed standards for how Great Lakes vessels had to be built to carry cargoes and to be insured. They had to be built of white oak, and in the case of the F.J. King, in the neighborhood of 20 acres of white oak forest had to be cut down, virgin white oak forest, to build that ship. Shipbuilding on the Great Lakes gradually moved westward as the forests were depleted in the eastern United States. By the time of the 1850s, 1860s, the yards in Manitowoc and Milwaukee had come online, mostly because there wasn't much wood in the east anymore. The masts could be made of other things, often pine, because you had to have, they were made in two pieces. There was the main part of the mast and then the top mast, which was joined to it. Masts could be, on the F.J. King, the vessel was 140 feet long, so the masts were probably around 140 feet tall. So finding that kind of pine in the area also became quite difficult. But, white oak, and the masts were made of pine. There was little else. It was almost all white oak.
And not much metal involved.
Well, there actually was quite a bit of iron.
Was.
The fastenings on a schooner are heavy iron pieces, the size of your forearm.
Okay.
They would join the keelsons together with very heavy iron fastenings. The frames would be joined with these heavy iron fastenings. And actually, when we find a ship that was lost under, say, a sandy beach, and it's completely buried, that's sort of how we can identify it, is if you use a magnetometer, you measure where the big metal pieces are, put flags in the sand, and then put a string around the whole thing, and you measure it. You can tell what's under the sand because of the iron fittings on these ships.
Oh, okay. Trouble, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And I did want to take a moment. On November 10th, we will be talking about the Edmund Fitzgerald on the show. And I didn't want to, for those of you who are interested in shipwrecks and there's always a lot of interest in the Edmund Fitzgerald, we'll be doing that show on November 10th. So that's going to be a lot of fun as well. The shipwreck itself was discovered on June 28th and in 2 hours, I think it was. We were on the water for 2 hours, right?
That's about right, yeah.
Oh, man, after all those years, and then to find it in a couple hours. But the public announcement of the find wasn't made until September 15th, so it took 2.5 months to make that discovery known.
Well, I think the important part was that we cooperate very closely with the Wisconsin Historical Society and the state underwater archaeologist. It's important to us that the sites be documented archaeologically pre-disturbance, so before anybody gets out there and can do anything. It took some time for them to have the staff available and the time. They're very busy. They only have 2 staff members. So kudos to Tamara Thompson and her staff for coming out there and doing such a wonderful model and helping us tell the story. When we did put out the press release, and we do this, when we find a wreck, we put out a national press release, and there's a reason for that. We have what I consider sort of a magic 2 weeks when we announce a wreck to educate the public about its significance. We learned from hard experience that anonymous wrecks are the most vulnerable wrecks. A good case in point is the Wisconsin's most historic shipwreck, the schooner Gallinipper off of Sheboygan. She was found in 1991 when snagged by some commercial fishermen. Her find was never reported. Well, a small group of divers knew where it was, and you know, in the ensuing years, they cut the ship's ornate scroll figurehead off and stole the steering wheel. Neither of those artifacts have ever been seen again. 10 years later, the ship was finally identified as the Gallinipper, as a fur trading schooner owned by the Dousman family, you know, a very important family here in Wisconsin. Had that ship's identity been known, had its story been told, those artifacts probably never would have been stolen. And so we try to really tell the story of these ships. We try to get the community involved. We try to get the community to adopt that ship into their cultural history. So, you know, Bailey's Harbor, Cana Island Lighthouse, you know, that's now part of the stories of those communities. And that helps not only preserve the shipwreck, but it helps those communities through tourism, through storytelling. In this case, it's a deep wreck, only accessible to scuba divers, but many of the wrecks can be visited by paddleboarders and kayakers. So an important part of their cultural history.
So I was, I don't know if I should have been surprised, but it seemed surprising to me that the discovery of the F.J. King was, it was covered by the New York Times, CNN, People magazine, the Smithsonian magazine. So why do you think the national organizations, media organizations, were so interested in what you found?
Well, I think part of it is that we have a track record of doing this. We build up a database of media outlets. When we do a press release, we put it out to them. We also do a media kit where we put pre-approved images up, and we give a very nice pre-written, you know, press kit, talking points. So that really, it's kind of their work is done for them if they want to run the story. I think part of it, too, though, is this fascination with shipwrecks. People, you know, a mystery solved after so many years. It does have that appeal for people. And in talking to those reporters who covered the story, they tell me that those stories just get a lot of clicks no matter where they are. But particularly in America on the Great Lakes. I think it's just because a lot of people have roots here. There still is a big community of people whose ancestors sailed on the Great Lakes. And it really is an important part of the story of the building of America, the industrialization of America. You know, the Great Lakes were that freshwater freeway that brought all the raw goods to the east. You know, and some people say that, for example, if Siberia had been connected to Moscow by a system of lakes, they would have developed into a superpower, but they just didn't have a way to transport raw goods like we had here on the Great Lakes. And so that story is still very appealing to people and an important part of our history.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you kind of mentioned this, but Wisconsin oversees shipwrecks near its shores, I think, differently from, I think, other states for sure.
We have a slightly different cultural approach that really started with our state historical societies. Way of dealing with shipwrecks. So in 1987, most of the shipwrecks, the vast majority on the Great Lakes, were given stewardship by the states through the Abandoned Shipwreck Act. So Michigan, for example, decided to start an underwater preserve system, which was really designed for sport divers. It was a tourism resource. Whereas Wisconsin decided to approach all our sites as archaeological sites. And the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association was founded, actually, to help document those sites and tell their stories. Whereas in Michigan, there was no documentation. There was no storytelling. There was just come and dive the shipwrecks and, you know, pay and put money in our communities. Not a bad approach, but it hastened the destruction of their wrecks. Whereas here, we put our wrecks on the National Register of Historic Places. We have more wrecks on the National Register of Historic Places than any other state in the Union. And it's because we try to tell the stories of the wrecks and establish their historical significance so that people respect them and don't damage them and that communities can leverage them as part of their community history for tourism.
Yeah. And I'm sure the F.J. King, if it hasn't been done already, will be put up for that nomination for inclusion.
It has been nominated to the National Register. Tammy Thompson, I think just completed the nomination. Of course, we helped with the research, but yeah, it's a process we go through. And once the ship is named to the National Register, we're going to release its location to sport divers. We hope to release it at our annual event, the Ghost Ships Festival, which is held in March in Manitowoc. We also will have a number of other major shipwreck discoveries there from people from across the lakes. But the F.J. King will be discussed there, and we will actually release the location, hopefully.
Pretty cool place to announce all that. The shipbuilders community. Yeah,
definitely. We love having our event in Manitowoc. It's we put our remote operated vehicles in the swimming pool, and you know, people and children can come and swim the ROVs around some little pseudo shipwrecks that we put in the pool. And we have a lot of vendors and, you know, all sorts of people giving presentations on new shipwreck discoveries, on underwater technology. It's quite an event.
We'll have to get you back at about that time, just ahead of it, so we can sort of promote that, because I think a lot of people would be interested in it for sure.
Yeah.
Mark and Sister Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I was in the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and my commander, he used to be a historian. He worked in Milwaukee, and he often talked about the 10,000 or more shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and that they only really found about 4,500 of them. And I had a relative that was on the Edmund Fitzgerald and went down, Oliver J. Buck Champeau. So that was a close cousin of mine.
Oh, well, Mark, I'm sorry for that, but your information, I think, is spot on, is it not?
He's definitely right about that. Probably around 10,000 wrecks, give or take 1,000. Depends on what you call a wreck, too. A lot of ships, you know, didn't sink out in the lake. They went under the ashore on a beach. A lot were towed out and scuttled when they outlived their usefulness. So if you add up all the ships that are buried somewhere or that are out on the bottom, it's probably around 10,000. Interesting thing, I went through our databases. I was involved in creating a database of all the ships ever lost on the Great Lakes over a period of about 20 years, a group of about 20 maritime historians. It was a collaborative effort. And I went through that database and took out only those that went down out in the lake and are still missing. It turns out that Lake Michigan still has 220 ships that are lost, that are missing out in deep water, and have not been found. Comparatively, the other lakes have less. Lake Huron has only about half that. Lake Superior only has about a quarter of that. But a lot of those ships now are getting harder and harder to find. They're farther from shore. But what I do is I go through that list and I prioritize them, you know, and I reinvestigate them. And so, you know, for me, the F.J. King was sort of in the top 10, right? And I thought, well, I'm going to reinvestigate that. It's like opening up a cold case file. And I started looking through it, and I was digging for new resources, things that people – that didn't exist when it was first investigated. And that's sort of how we found the account. So, yeah, those numbers are about right. And, yeah, the Fitz, I think, also has a special place in Great Lakes memory. And with the 50th anniversary coming up, you know, remembering not just the ship – but the people who were lost on it and the story it tells of, you know, really that industrial commerce on the Great Lakes and how it helped build America, all those sailors on the Fitz and the many, many thousands that went before that gave their lives do an important part in telling that story.
Well, your group, this is the fifth ship you found in 3 years. That's a pretty good record.
I think it's because we have been spending more time at it lately. We used to focus more on documenting ships that and sites that had already been found, inland sites too. We don't just do Great Lakes work. We for example, we did an archaeological side scan survey of the bottom of the Crawfish River off Aztalan. We've done Devil's Lake. We've done a number of inland sites, but. These sites, because we've purchased this equipment, we've started to look for shipwrecks more. And we take a very scientific and methodical approach to it. When we especially in terms of what we choose to look for, to put it bluntly, we look for shipwrecks we think we can find.
Well, you were teasing me a little earlier about another find.
Not another find, but another one we're looking for. Yes, we're currently out in the field looking for another ship. I don't know that we'll find it. It's a pretty difficult search. But we always have a few. Now, we have next year, we're hoping to do the same type of project again, where we take a group of citizen scientists out on a large boat, and we look for a ship that is still missing. And we have a ship in mind, but you know, these have to be approved by our board of directors. We sure. actually have a project and field work committee that reviews things. And we actually have real credentialed yeah. underwater archaeologists who we run this stuff by before we go and do a project. We don't just sort of shoot from the hip. But if they decide to approach the project, we're going to do it again. And we'll take another group of citizen scientists out and, you know, we're probably not going to find it. But honestly, we try to.
But you're going to have a heck of a lot of fun looking.
Yeah, we do. It is. It's huge fun. Everybody really enjoys it. We have a good time. We get to know new people with like interests. It's a great time. So we're looking forward to it. And we hope to do it again and find another shipwreck next year with the public.
Brendan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Brendan Balod is president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. He's always got some really cool stuff to talk about, and look forward to another visit from him down the road. Up next, we'll talk about the transformation of the Portage County Historical Society with Executive Director John Henry, and also joining us, Janet Seymour, who is the Outreach Director of the Wisconsin Historical Society. That next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.